episode number 805. This is the audio version. You're welcome to find the video as well as all of our programming at epostle.net. That's apostle with an E. That's apostolic evangelism for an electronic and expanding universe. So whether you watch us, because we look so cute over here, or you're just listening to us, sit back, relax, and get ready to take the next step. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I hope it's a good one for you. It has to be, because you're with us today. Yes, you are at the next step, the Epostle program that is now in its 17th year of doing podcasts and interviews, and I'm so glad that we have a repeat guest today. You're not going to believe the repeat that it's taking. But first of all, let me welcome you and tell you that if you're watching on YouTube, that's fine. But if you want to listen, we are continuing to do just the audio only. That's available on Apple Podcasts and so on. You could just pick up the audio, and it's very recommended for you if you're driving and listening to us. Today, my guest is Dikrana Zakharyan. She is an international humanitarian activist and a consultant regarding refugee response. I first met you about 10 years ago.
2015,
we were commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, and you were on a project, and one of our mutual friends introduced us and said, you got to meet each other. So anyway, welcome to the Western Diocese Studios. I'm glad you're with us. Dikrana comes from Paris, France. And so you're on a small little couple weeks, and I'm glad we got you into the studio today to share some ideas. And I thought it would be nice to talk about the Armenian experience, like what it means to be Armenian and navigating through the world today. So first of all, welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you for having me again, Father Vazgen.
Tell us a little bit about how we met, because that was a very special time, especially because our friend is physically no longer with us. Yeah.
So thank you so much for having me, and I'm so honored to be a repeat guest and to see how your podcast has grown over the course of the past 10 years. So how did you and I meet? It was 2015, and so I'm currently based in Paris, but I did grow up in Los Angeles, born in Armenia, raised in LA, did not grow up in the Armenian community, and just around that time, I wanted, as we were approaching the centennial, I wanted to become more active in community organizing, specifically with the Armenian diaspora, but using Los Angeles as kind of the launching pad of connecting the diverse communities that live in Southern California and Los Angeles County specifically, that are also immigrant diaspora communities that have a shared history of genocide. And so I was selected to be a part of a fellowship, which is the Carl Wilkins Fellowship, that was organized by our two very dear friends, Katie J. Scott and Gabe, who have since transitioned on into another realm, if we can say, another existence, but were the founders of a wonderful organization called IACT, which still continues until today. It was started out of the Save Darfur movement and since went on to work with communities around the world, mainly through sports and early childhood education. And just around that time, I was introduced by them to them. Their organization took on a fellowship, which was called the Carl Wilkins Fellowship, that would connect community organizers throughout the United States that were working specifically on building constituencies, American constituencies that can stand up on behalf of those who have been and continue to be affected by genocide and mass atrocities. So I got to be a part of it as someone who was starting out as a community organizer, but some of my colleagues were the heads of museums throughout the United States, teachers, political activists, and so forth. And why is it called the Carl Wilkins Fellowship? Well, Carl Wilkins was the only American that stayed in Rwanda during the 1994 genocide when he had the option to evacuate. He did not, and he went on to save many civilians. during that period, and a fellowship was created in his honor. So how does that connect to you and I? Well, in 2015, in honor of the centennial of the Armenian Genocide, I wanted to organize a panel of individuals, civilians from Los Angeles, who either have directly experienced or through their lineage have experienced genocide through the course of the past 100 years. We're talking 2015. So you were on the panel as someone who spoke on behalf of the Armenian experience, and we brought together a woman who was a refugee from Cambodia, a woman who was a survivor of the Rwandan genocide, who has since rebuilt her life in Los Angeles, two survivors of the European Holocaust. And at the time, I was looking for someone who can speak on behalf of the Armenian experience, which is very particular given we were commemorating a centennial. Right. And it was just around that time that Katie, Jay, and Gabe said, you should really speak to Father Vazgen. He has also traveled to Rwanda, where I had studied under...
I think at some point we were the only two people that had one foot in the Armenian genocide and one in the first and one in the last genocide.
And when I learned there was someone named Father Vazgen who had also traveled to Rwanda and had this maybe a similar walking parallel paths in different
parallel
ways.
Paths. Yeah, we have, yeah. But, you know, when you did an interview with me back then, and it was interesting because we were at some coffee spot, and we just kind of ran a microphone during our conversation and threw that into the a podcast. And I remember something that you said, which it's so profound in its simplicity. You said, if the Armenian genocide is the first of the 20th century, that means there had to have been more. You know, there were so many more. Like, no duh. Yeah, of course, you know, there has to be. And this is one of the things that I admire about the work that you do. It's you're weaving these genocides together to find some common layers that hopefully will eliminate this word, but we're seeing them pop up anyway. After 10 years of working like this since we last met, what's your perception of this? Are we any closer to seeing no more genocide? And it's a rhetorical question because we know what's going on. Yeah, go ahead.
So what I would say is I think no matter what side of the aisle people fall on, I think humanity, at least as we can say in the global West, where we have really pioneered and developed these concepts of international human rights and genocide prevention and international law, and everything which followed after the Second World War, we're grappling with how our perception of the reality we've created and also these social constructs and these norms and these agreements that we were working towards have really fallen apart right before our eyes, with especially how exacerbated it's all felt within the last 2 years of having a genocide in Gaza televised to us, where it's unprecedented that we've been bombarded and seen this type of imagery so explicitly just on our cell phones every single day. So, you know, on a personal level, I'm really at a point of grieving how when I started out as a community organizer 10 years ago and how I went on to pursue my career internationally, the promise that no longer exists for me and taking the world as it is today, which is, and I'm not saying this from the lens of a pessimist or something like that, but I think we need to function in reality, which is we live in a dangerous world, a one which is authoritarianism, violence, and military rule has become the norm. And so what do we do when we are, from a theoretical framework, from a philosophical framework, we want to believe in universal human rights, and we want to believe by sharing history and sharing experiences that can lead to prevention, which has actually been promised to us mm-hmm. as well, whether it was through academia and scholarship or whether it was through political advocacy or through law. That was the norm that we were all fighting towards, and that's been ripped up right before our eyes. So do I see us working closer towards a world where we can wholeheartedly and honestly say we are coming closer to a promise of genocide no longer existing? We're not there. Absolutely, not there. We are not there. And that's multifaceted in terms of what humanity is up against.
What we're seeing right now in the world is like, how, and I'd like your insight on this, having not only studied it, but to have lived with many refugees. Mm-hmm. What's that point, or what happens when, I mean, we spoke a few minutes ago that both of us have been to Rwanda, and one of the startling things that we loved about Rwanda was they had this genocide museum where we were, the Armenians were the heroes, and now that's gone. So something has happened where somebody got paid off, somebody, it's obvious, we don't need to, you know, you don't need to be hit on the head with it. But what is that point where the victim of genocide now finds it okay to forget about others and also perpetrate genocide?
So what Father Vazgen is referring to for our listeners, is what you and I really bonded over, is that in the national genocide memorial in Kigali, Rwanda, the first room you walk into reflects on the past genocides of the 20th century, and the first exhibit was the Armenian genocide exhibit. And when you and I met, we really reflected on that together, that, you know, we come from Armenia, which is this tiny country tucked away in the Caucasus, and then we visited a landlocked country in Central Africa, which, you know, both relatively the size of the state of Vermont, just to put into perspective for listeners, and to find your own history being reflected as a part of this broader collective, and what that meant for us as descendants of the Armenian genocide. And it is very, I think, just from a human level, it's very painful to see how quickly we can work towards bridging history together, reflecting on the universal struggle for human rights and genocide prevention and democracy and all of these, if I can say, fluffy concepts. Mm. And the reason I use that term is because it's very, very tedious, and it takes day to day to work towards those principles, and it can be destroyed so quickly. Mm. It's a very fleeting thing we're talking about. We're experiencing it in our own country, where we're seeing these institutions in the United States, which is a very young country. I mean, now I live in Western Europe. I live in France, which is a very, in comparison to the U.S., I really joke with so many of my French counterparts where I say, do not compare France and the U.S. We can compare on some levels in terms of being international superpowers and all, but in terms of the trajectory of the development of these two countries, just put it into context, the city of Paris is older than than all of the United States, if we look at it like that, right? So when we see how hard in the U.S., literally through blood, we have fought to build our institutions, it could just be gone. Right. So when we think about, now let's take it globally, right, where it's not a given that just because a collective of people, a country, a community has been a victim of something, they will go on to be pillars of prevention. Right. It is actually much more common that the victim becomes the perpetrator.
Well, the assumption was there, right, how could you do it? But so what is that? What happens? What triggers them to say, I'm going to forget about what we went through, and now I'm going to perpetrate this?
I actually don't think it's a matter of forgetting. Uh-huh. I think what we are experiencing in the era that we are in, we just fed off of the example, which is the Armenian component of a museum has been now deleted. It's been stripped away from us.
Just to let our listeners, viewers know about that. So this, when I was there in 2006, you were there?
In 2012.
12, okay. And there was this beautiful room that we felt, wow, the world could not recognize us, but here in the middle of darkest Africa is, wow, this room.
Smack dab in the middle of Africa.
Right in the middle.
Yeah, right in the middle.
And it's on the equator, too.
Yes, on the equator. Here's a snippet of what the Armenians have gone through, because also I'm very careful not to make our entire history revolve around a genocide, right? We're an ancient civilization.
Absolutely.
But a snippet of what we've gone through was
well, the thing for me was when I walked into that room was reading the stories of the survivors, and they were the exact, identical stories that my grandparents had told me about, like the gendarmes coming in the middle of the night and taking away the women for rape, and the men being put into these things, kids on the, and it was just too bizarre. And I remember sitting there crying like a baby, and this docent came up to me and said, what's the problem? And I said, well, this reminds me. And she said, well, what genocide? That was my wake-up call when she said, which genocide? Like, what? There's more than one?
The term which.
Yeah, which genocide? Interesting. Like, what? And she said, well, have you been up to the room? I think it was on the second floor. She took me there. And when she opened the door, I was in shock that here we are. We don't need to prove it anymore. It's there. So what happened there? They got rid of it.
They got rid of it, and what I would just say, because we can really go on just to talk about the politics of what the state of Rwanda has become, but what I would say, again, is every country goes through its own reconciling of when you go through something so traumatic, how you position yourself in the world, and if we can draw parallels, because that's how you and I started, is through the comparative lens, is that it become we are now in the era of hyper-militarization, and diplomacy is, it's only met through aggression and very radical positioning, hardline politics, and so we should not operate in a way that just we will be learning from history. That was the big promise of what how post World War II Europe was formed, right? How the United States positioned itself is that essentially, if we group together, if we create these international institutions, at a very minimum, we will not go to war with each other.
Right.
At a very minimum. We can police the global south and the rest of the world. But what we've actually seen is these principles, again, of human rights and international law, it's actually the global south communities that are holding us to account and taking the state of Israel to the International Court of Justice, and it's Brazil standing up and these other countries that are actually using the principles that we've created. So I don't know what it is in terms of why it happens. What I can say is we have enough case studies in history that it does happen, and the latter is actually a much more pursuable approach, because we don't have to look very far. Me growing up as an American with, having been born in Armenia, my mother is a refugee from Baku. Her family fled in 1988 to Russia. I have my father's side of the family lives in Armenia. Mom's side lives in Russia. I grew up in the U.S. I assume the American history as well, and my position in the world in this particular point in history as an American, and I take on that responsibility of what the U.S. is perpetrating in the world and the blood that is on our hands as Americans in terms of the genocide in Gaza. I'm not from the United States originally, but I cannot wipe my hands clean of that. Right. In the same way as I feel a great sense of responsibility to Native American communities and African American communities. However, I think just on a spiritual level, like books and news and politics aside, I do wonder, is this just the U.S. essentially fulfilling what it has been in the course of history, which has been a very violent state?
You know, in cancer therapy, there's this thing now that they're talking about, like, we're not going to get rid of cancer. Mm-hmm. Then the only way that you can deal with cancer is now early detection. Can we say the same thing about genocide, that maybe we're not going to get rid of this? Sadly, we're not going to get rid of cancer. We're not going to get, this is going to happen. So
this is an actual principle that you're discussing, which is the early warning signs, right?
Well, we know those early, but it didn't do any good in Gaza, right?
Right.
We saw them.
And it's also, this is why I say, I think we are in the era. And again, for listeners, I am not someone who's fatalistic or extreme, but I think we are in the era now where the pillars that we wanted to lean into, democracy, freedom of speech, human rights, are essentially non-viable because everything is actually leaning towards digital communication, algorithms, militarization, violence, non-diplomacy, hardline approaches. I can't come to think of an international leader I currently trust.
Can you talk about that fluffization?
Yeah.
Of thing I and you said about digital communication. I always wonder, have we been desensitized because of the digital age? Just the fact that you go on any social media platform and you see pictures of somebody's grandchildren enjoying the park, and the next picture you see is children dying of hunger. And so somehow in that feed, these have been equated. There's a feed about children having fun, feed about children dying of hunger. And so we've been desensitized in a sense. And that fluffiness comes. Oh, yeah, it's nice. There's kids playing there. Too bad these kids aren't, you know.
Social media is, and the way we consume information, from a cognitive perspective, is a very recent phenomena in the evolution of human beings. So we can only understand this in retrospect and backwards, and what we have enough information to know that it has forever changed our cognitive function as human beings and how we relate to one another, mm-hmm. on a societal level, and also how we socialize with one another, right? So there's enough to feed off of where we can say there is a negative effect on us in terms of how we are able to empathize and relate to one another. And I think right now in society, actually, that keyword empathy is what's highly lacking because of the era of algorithms and curated reality, meaning that if it is not validating my perspective, my position, my interests in the world, then it is not valid. Or if I haven't directly lived it or experienced it, that means I can't possibly be there for someone who has, or I can't understand. And actually, empathy is not walking directly in the shoes of someone else and having that exact shared experience. Actually, it's quite the contrary. It's when you can relate to someone on a human level, even if you have not directly walked in their shoes. And this is from an activist perspective. What I always say is, we're 8 billion on the planet. Not every single person is going to do everything all at the same time. And I do actually fundamentally believe most human beings are just trying to get by, just on a day-to-day basis. I believe most people want to feed their families, take care of themselves, and just survive, and especially in this day and age where it's hard. And when people are really kind of soaked like a sponge, squeezed like a sponge, I should say, and they have their very last bit of energy, last bit of strength, they're not going to be functioning at their best. Mm-hmm. However, there are people like you and I who are, if I can say, despite our own problems we have in our lives, and also, we're privileged enough to be sitting here having this conversation and talking on these topics, which means that there are millions of others just like us who are in the position, who do have the knowledge, who do have the resources, the network, and the will. And where I always find a sense of vision in it, it's not everyone is going to be able to stand up Mm-hmm. Not everyone can stand up. And especially the most vulnerable communities who fall victim to the things we're talking about. Therefore, it is up to people like us who can, that should do it. But not everyone can do it. So if we have a universal expectation of every single person to act accordingly, we're just always going to be disappointed.
It's always a question. When I think about the Armenian genocide, how did people allow that to happen? That was the big question, right? Well, you know, and then we made that parallel. Yeah. When it happened to the Jews, the Holocaust, we were the ones that brought up the Hitler quote, you know, who after all remembers the, and we said, well, you see, 15 years after the genocide, they had already forgotten. And we thought that if you remember, it's going to prevent it. And after that, we see Cambodia, we see Ethiopia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and then Darfur, and now Sudan, Congo. You've been to the Congo. You've been to Sudan or Uganda?
Uganda. Lived in Uganda for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. So you've been to all of these different places that where genocide is the norm, or they actually talk about it because out of a reference to themselves, as opposed to just reading it in a book. Tell me, how do you see this all coming together? Our topic, how do we as Armenians navigate in this world? And you know.
So I'm someone who I learn through people. And because of me as Tigrana, the way I have found direction and reconciled with my own family history has been to connect it to a global community, because otherwise I felt very small in my pain. And what I have essentially, how I've positioned myself, is to just sit and listen to people. Because I'm someone who comes to these types of communities with an immense amount of privilege that I can even be there. And this is true because most people just do not even have the resources or the time to get a visa, get on a flight, and spend your time under a tree or in a hut just listening to people talk about their lives. Mm-hmm. And it actually came... It got to a point where, after a while, when I was really interacting with refugee communities in Uganda, where I worked for 3 years, I really had to, you know, I kind of just threw myself in. I moved there when I was 24 years old. And it is really that thing of, like, being a young person and just, like, in Armenian, we say paylun achkerov with rose-colored glasses, and you say, I'm just going to do this thing. And... But after, I wasn't trained on, like, research methodology or any of this. I trained myself. I learned myself. But part of it was because I wasn't someone who, like, came with my research methods and my all of this. I kind of just talked to people that they were more receptive to speak to me because it was just this, like, humility, actually. And it's just breaking bread with people and speaking to people. And actually, when I then transitioned on, like, beyond just being a researcher, but actually working with NGOs, and then went on to work with the World Bank and doing much more development, policy-driven stuff. I was then able to, like, create my own research methods and my own tools, which is don't assume that someone has time to talk to you just because they are a refugee, or don't assume someone wants to talk to you just because you are a visitor. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all of the, especially working in that part of the world in East and Central Africa, where they are bombarded by all kinds of initiatives, students, NGOs. I mean, one of my friends who's South Sudanese, he's a refugee and also an activist and also a researcher. He jokes with me and he says, Tigrana, do you know how many PhDs my country has personally produced? South Sudan is just kind of, any topic. People go and they research there. And one time I was actually corrected. I was working for a consulting firm in Paris, and I said something. There was a colleague on the call and who was from Nigeria, and I say this with all my humility because I was quite humbled, where he had asked me where I had worked in Africa, and I said, oh, like I've worked here, here, and here, and I really miss working in the field. And later my colleague said to me, you know, I don't know if we should say working in the field, because what you're referring to is actually his country. And, you know, and it's actually such a position of privilege to say something like that, because, you know, I was a Fulbright scholar, and I've worked with the State Department to get young African leaders to come to the U.S. and do leadership training here. It's called the Yali Fellowship. It was started under former President Barack Obama. You know, so when so many of my African friends have come to the U.S., they don't refer coming to the U.S. as coming to the field.
That's true.
Even though could technically say.
Right, you could, yeah.
So I think it's just a matter of, like, on an individual level, really, like, knowing your position on things and really practicing humility on that. I'll give another personal example, which is I've traveled to the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo twice. And in Bukavu, I was hosted by a women's association. They hosted me for 10 days. And I would just follow them around and just sit in on their meetings and speak with people and converse with people. And one time I was speaking to two women, and I used the term militia. You know, we're talking about Congo, which is, it's a very fine line between state and non-state actors. And I use the term militia as opposed to a soldier. And I was corrected. One of the women said, my dear, that militia you're referring to are our sons.
Wow.
And you have to, and it's a very, you know, sometimes people can say something too very simple, but it means so much. Just like for you, the term witch genocide, it can really change the way you see things.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I think I told you this over a coffee, I was speaking to a general in Congo, and we were speaking specifically about these illegal mines that so many of we in the global West have just benefited from these minerals being pillaged from Congo. And Congo is home to the second largest national rainforest after the Amazon. We should be thanking this country. And I, just hearing these stories of all of this illegal trafficking, and I just said to him, I'm just so sorry. I'm just so sorry. I don't even know. You know, all I can say is I'm sorry. And he looked at me, and in that moment he said, right now I just see you as an Armenian girl. What has Armenia done to Congo? I was speaking to him as an American.
Yes. Yeah.
And he just looked at me
very
and said,
interesting, yeah.
In this moment, Tigrana, you're just a young Armenian girl.
It's interesting to me because you've got these identities, and we all come in with different identities. And
it's what you lean into.
It's what
you
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Because all of it is valid.
Yeah.
All of it is valid. And so just to connect to, you know, we are not there yet in terms of genocide prevention. We can't even kid ourselves that we are even in that evolved as human beings,
right,
like on a global stage, on a local level. I mean, we're in Los Angeles. This is my hometown. Every time I come to LA, the things I see in terms of the socioeconomic discrepancy here and people suffering, you know, we don't have to look far.
Yeah.
So what I can say is right now we live in a world as Armenian people who carry this very complex history and how we position ourselves is knowing that our history is not what's actually going to create like a bigger moral conscience in the world right now. we wanted to believe that.
We wanted to believe
we
that.
We wanted, yeah. And we created a lot of initiatives to back that up. But we are not in that era anymore. Yeah. The world has changed a lot.
Has changed,
And I think what we're going through is that, one, reconciling, because we have to, it's very hard to face reality. It's much easier to stay in the past and wonder why things are not, you know, and giving ourselves grace as well.
Well, I think that's why some of us at that time, you know, 20 years ago, we're talking about let's get out of this ghetto mentality that this has only happened to us. And that whole idea why we went to Darfur, why we focused on what was going on in the Sudan or thing was like, okay, yeah, that happened to us 100 years ago. Why aren't we doing something about now? And unfortunately, here we are in 2025 and asking the same question, why aren't we doing anything? Just really saddens me in many ways, but hearing you, hearing others, you have the hope because there is a younger generation that's picking up the tools that have been left over to them and saying, let's talk about these things. Let's try to find some answers. It may not be the answers that I was looking for, but there are other answers.
And maybe it's a matter of we are creating new ways to find those answers, and we haven't found them yet. And what I can say is it's very appealing to want to run away from that and to create shortcuts.
Oh, yeah.
It's much harder to sit with discomfort and pain. But the only way through is through. We have to, you know, we have to go through it. It's very painful. And so we want the quick fix on things, but what you and I are speaking about here are deep topics, heavy topics, historical topics.
As an Armenian, because the general even said you're an Armenian, so as an Armenian,
today you're an Armenian.
Yeah. How do you let's bring it to some kind of a conclusion here? Mm-hmm. How do you navigate through this world right now? What are the tools that you bring to the table? What are the things that you use to navigate your life and the world?
Mm-hmm. Know that you are one person. And so as one person, as one individual, it's give yourself grace on where your limits are. Mm-hmm. It's okay to have limits. Not to limit yourself, but to know that it is okay to care for yourself, to take care of yourself, to nurture yourself. And when you can come to terms with your limits, you can then see yourself, I think, as a broader collective as well, because you see yourself as one who's a part of many. I think it's very important to return to community. We need to take care of each other, and we need to get back into being in person. It's very, use technology, use social media, use the tools that are available to us as just that. They're tools. They're just tools. They have no, put them in their rightful place, but they do not need to be the rule.
Right.
And I must say, and this is not without taking away from everything we've discussed, these tools that we're discussing are, they're private companies. They should not have a monopoly on how we interact as human beings. Just put them in their place and use. It's not like you use a hammer or a screwdriver every day. You use it when you need it.
They're byproducts of the whole capitalist thing that we, you know, somebody's making money off of it. It's not because they want to see world peace, right?
And just because you haven't had the same experience as someone doesn't invalidate you from empathizing with them, from understanding them. You don't need to go on and it's okay just to sit with the discomfort of the world. I think we are now, because no one knows where this is going. I'm not someone who is, I try not to be too negative on these things, but we're living in a dangerous, unpredictable world, sincerely, and we need to be quite grounded in the way we navigate that. So I think that's how I would say it on a personal level. Now, where I find some excitement, where I find optimism, where I find there's, you know, like a different type of sparkle in my eyes, if I can say, not the rose-colored glasses type, but really like a something which is driving me right now is, okay, there's no rules anymore to this. All of the roadmaps that we were promised, we were told if you do these things, if you subscribe to these institutions and to these frameworks of thinking, and to the, then it will lead us to this like broader good, this broader collective age of humanity, and where we uphold international human rights, and there's economic equality, and no person under the sun is going to succumb to genocide and all of this. All of that is gone. So, what does that mean? No one can limit us or tell us that our ideas are stupid, our ideas are wrong, our ideas are radical, because it is the moment to try new things, completely try new things. And it's that is a minimum at this point, because we cannot continue doing the same thing and, of course, expecting a different result. I'm not saying let's not support the UN. I'm not saying let's not support community-based organizations and NGOs and all. But at the same time, use the tools that are available to us, but at the same time, know their limits and try, open ourselves up to a new era of doing things which no one is, that we are in a place where we're creating that. There is no map. There is no framework. We are kind of on a blank slate. Open ourselves up to a new era of doing things which no one is. That we are in a place where we're creating that. There is no map. There is no framework. We are kind of on a blank slate. That is scary. That is scary. But that's again, it's all intertwined. That's why I say we need each other. We need to be having these types of conversations. You and I are here today on a podcast, but we had this conversation over our coffee as well. Let's normalize that.
Let's normalize it. That, anyway, beautiful place for us to put a bookmark in it rather than an ending. But thank you. And all I could do is wish you all the best as you head back to Paris. But let's make this a conversation. Yes. Now let's use the technology as a tool. We don't have to wait to have coffee in the same room. We can have it across the ocean and continue this discussion, which I'd love to do. I hope you're on board with that. But I want to thank you. You give so much to think about, and I hope our listeners, our viewers, will take with them a lot of this. If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way?
So online, it's going to be on LinkedIn. I prefer to maintain privacy in my personal life, so I'm not on social media. However, I love to get in touch for professional projects. So LinkedIn is the best way to get in touch with me, or just to share and exchange ideas. Also, I love it when people just come talk to me. So if you see me in Paris or Los Angeles or in Yerevan or anywhere else in the world, please just come say hello.
Well, how about that? Would you say hi to her? I hope you would. Wasn't that an incredible interview? Hope you enjoyed it. Hey, listen, you can find that as well as many, many other interviews and the entire catalog of The Next Step, as well as daily messages and videos, all kinds of stuff. 360 videos, and how about the metaverse? It's all available on epostle.net. That's Apostolic Evangelism for an Electronic and Expanding Universe. Check it out, okay? You need to check it out. You need to connect with Epostle, and while you're there, let us know what you think. Drop us a note. Put a little message out to us at info@epostle.net, or of course on the website on the many, many boards where you can leave your comments. And also make sure you sign up for the newsletter. It comes out every couple weeks and just gives you a little assessment of all the things that we're doing. That does it for our show today. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed producing it for you. behalf of the wonderful staff that I have over here, including Susie, my producer, and Ken, our engineer, this is Father Boskin, inviting you to join us again when we will take the next step.
For disclaimer.
And now here's the fine print. The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the next step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the next step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskullness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of epostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
Epostle.net. Apostolic evangelism for an electronic and expanding universe.
I forgot to ask you if you're seeing the same sky as we are. Bye.